be different, but number one, I think there are two things. Number one, when you know someone, it does make a difference. That's human nature. And number two, this was also, it's horrendous to even think about it, to say it, but this involved not just killing. This involved torture and just an evil which is really beyond human comprehension. And what Hashem is allowing to happen, I think, and we don't know why Hashem, why these things happen, but in a sense Hashem is showing us what Joseph Conrad called the heart of darkness that lurks in terms of this entire process, and the recognition that we're not really dealing with human beings in a conventional sense. I don't want to say animals, because why should I insult dogs and cats? Animals kill when they feel threatened, or they kill in order to eat. We kill when we have to eat too. We kill animals, But viciousness and torture for the sake of torture, I think, is unknown really to the animal world. Animals do not do that. So this is something that. And what is the reaction? The reaction is to compare it to, again, to an axe, to a child that is brought into a military operation who accidentally gets injured. And just talking about that as being equivalent. And these sort of things are, we're really getting a lot of insight into who our partners are in this process. When the president of Syria can make a statement to the Pope Jews killing Jesus, they're going back to the Inquisition and the Middle Ages.
It's worse than his father, really. It's only 35 and he can die soon.
So maybe there is a blessing in getting the truth, knowing the truth, knowing what's going on. And then you can take steps. But the other lesson is, I think, that
and listening,
when you're truly in a hopeless situation, so then you know that you have to turn to God. Otherwise, you can operate under the illusion that you have a process, that there are things within your control, that there are things that can be done, that the progress can be made. But when you realize that that's impossible, so in effect, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to somehow get involved. They say by the Brisker Rav, with Velva Soloveitchik, who was by temperament a very, very nervous person. Brisker was he was a nervous person. And he was caught in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1944. He was smuggled out miraculously, really, in the middle of the Warsaw Ghetto. And people noticed he was unusually calm as bombs were going all around him and people were dropping dead in the streets. And somebody said, "How can you, of all people, be calm at a time like this?" And he said, "I'm nervous when there are things that I feel I ought to do and I'm not sure if I'm doing them. So I'm always worried, have I done what I'm able to do? When I'm in a situation where there is literally nothing that I can do as a human being, there is nothing I can do to help myself, then I'm very calm, because then I know if it's impossible for me to help myself, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to have to help me." So that's, in a way, kind of the situation that we're in. Anyway, it's brought down, if it's any comfort, it is brought down that when a person dies al kiddush Hashem, there is no suffering in that process.
You mean there's no being
known? No, I mean the body. The person that is dying al kiddush Hashem, like Rabbi Akiva, does not feel the physical thing. Fortunately, I can't answer. Does that include the preliminary? Where does that start, so to speak? I don't know. But I hope, pray that indeed it was that situation. Anyway, I wanted to share a little bit about the counting of the Omer. And again, this is based on the writings of the Maral and other Meforshim. We know that this week's Parsha is the source of the mitzvah of counting of the Omer. The Torah says, "Usvartem lachem imacharas haShabbos." You start counting the day after Shabbos. That's what it says literally. From the day that you bring the Omer offering, 7 weeks. Now, we know, of course, we begin counting the Omer the second day of Pesach. So how do we define Mimacharas HaShabbos, the day after Shabbos? Shabbos does not mean Saturday. Shabbos means Yom Tov, the day after Yom Tov. In Eretz Yisrael, right, only the first day was a Yom Tov. And we know that this was a great debate between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the Prushim. Right, the Prushim are the bad guys in the New Testament, but the Prushim are Chazal, and the Tzedukim, who did not believe in the oral tradition. The Tzedukim took, the Sadducees took the position that the word Shabbos in that verse meant Saturday. And in effect, therefore, they took the position that you always began counting the Omer on a Sunday. So whatever day Pesach was, the first Sunday after Pesach, no, or after the first day of Pesach, you would count the Omer. Now, apparently, this was a heresy that was widely accepted. People loved this, and Chazal went to tremendous lengths to try to prove in various ways that the meaning of Shabbos in that pasuk is not Shabbos Bereishis, not Saturday, but it refers to Pesach. Now you may ask, why was the Tzedukim's interpretation so popular? Right? Why was it very popular? So there are a few reasons why it's popular. Number one, it gave people a two-day vacation for Shavuos, which was always appreciated. Well, what do we mean? Because keep in mind that in Eretz Yisrael, Shavuos is of course only one day. Now, if you could connect, now if the Omer is begun on Sunday, so that means Shavuos will always be on Sunday, right? Because the 50th day is Sunday. So therefore, you guaranteed people a two-day vacation of Saturday, Sunday, a long weekend. And consequently, the Tzedukim's position was very popular, as opposed to the Prushim, where Shavuos could be any day of the week, and as a result, you only had one day and not 2 days. That's one idea. The other idea is that the Tzedukim, who did not believe, really, in the oral tradition, did not want to link the Day of the Ten Commandments to a date that depended on the actions of the Sanhedrin. What do I mean? Because if you count it from Pesach, Pesach depends on the sanctification of the new moon, which is an action of the Sanhedrin, as opposed to if you count Svira from Sunday and you're connecting it to the days of the week, you're not connecting Shavuos to an action of the Sanhedrin. You're connecting Shavuos to the natural seven-day cycle of the calendar. And since the Prushim wanted to sever and cut the oral law from the written law, right, Shavuos commemorates the written law, the Ten Commandments, therefore they wanted Shavuos to be based on Shabbos Bereishis, which is not a phenomenon of the Torah Shebaal Peh, as opposed to Pesach, which depends on the sanctification of the new moon, which is a function of the Sanhedrin.
Which Sunday did they start counting?
Yeah, well, that's a question. The truth is, they couldn't really escape it, because even according to them, it was the Sunday after Pesach. So the point is that indirectly it was connected. But
so Pesach started Wednesday, saying it was Sunday after that Wednesday.
That's correct. So it was not a uniform number of days from the second day of Pesach.
They always stopped at Shavuot?
They counted, they counted 49 days.
So their Shavuos
would be later.
Later.
That's correct. They didn't stop Shavuos. They count, because the Torah says Shavuos is, you count 49 days. So you're making a good point. Their problem was not only in when they counted the Omer, but they also had a difference in when they observed the holiday of Shavuos itself. Now, here we have a very simple question. If this is so conducive of confusion, is Shabbos Saturday, so the day after Shabbos is Sunday? Or is Shabbos the Yom Tov of Pesach, and the day afterwards is the second day of Pesach? Why doesn't the Torah say very pashut? Instead of saying, Usvartem lachem, you should count the Omer, Mimacharas HaShabbos, let it say, Usvartem lachem, you should count the Omer, Mimacharas HaPesach, from the day after Pesach. In other words, the first day of Pesach. That would avoid all ambiguities. Why have a lashon that is ambiguous and confusing when we could have had a lashon that is very clear and definite? Now, Lemaisa, the Eben Ezra says, even if it would have said Mimacharas HaPesach, that would have been ambiguous for the following reason. The term Pesach in the Torah, which is the holiday, sometimes refers to the day that you bring the Korban Pesach. Now, when do you bring the Korban Pesach? You bring the Korban Pesach on the 14th, and you eat it on the 15th. Now, if I were to define the word Pesach as the day that you bring the Korban Pesach, Mimacharata Pesach, the day after Pesach, would have meant you start the Omer on the first day of Pesach. So Pesach would have been ambiguous as well. But the truth, and therefore the Ibn Ezra argues, Shabbos is a better term, because Shabbos refers to a day that you are prohibited from doing work. And that doesn't apply to Erev Pesach, where you could do work. That would only apply to Yom Tov rather than Erev Pesach. But the problem is, it seems that according to the Ibn Ezra, you are substituting one ambiguity for another ambiguity. Meaning to say, if it would have said Pesach, you wouldn't have known, is it Erev Pesach, which is the day of the bringing of the Pesach, or is it Pesach, the first day of the Yom Tov? Shabbos successfully eliminates Erev Pesach, because that's not a day of refraining from work. But then you get the ambiguity, do we mean Pesach, or do we mean Saturday? Right? In other words, the Ibn Ezra's answer, that Mimacharas HaPesach would have been ambiguous, therefore it says Mimacharas HaShabbos, doesn't answer the problem that Mimacharas HaShabbos is ambiguous as well. Okay, well, you could even say that. B'yom HaSheni Shel Pesach. Well, I'm not sure. B'yom HaSheni Shel
Pesach. I don't know. Okay.
You could have said something. You could have said something. Right. Right, right. Okay, in other words, it should have said a Befeirish. Okay, something. So, here's a teretz I wanted to share with you from the Meshech Chachma. The Meshech Chachma, who is the Or Sameach, as he's known, and again, just want to tell you, just to digress for a second, totally unrelated, but the Or Sameach was the Rav of Davidsk in Latvia, and he died in the 1920s. And outside of the yeshiva world, he's not necessarily known. Most people know the yeshiva Or Sameach, which is actually named after him, because he died without any surviving children. But Rav Meir Simcha was the Misnaged Rav, was the non-Hasidic Rav in Davinsk, which was a small town. And then there was a Hasidic Rav, and both of them were the greatest Gedolim of their generation. It's amazing how one little small town had two rabbis who were Gedolim. Rav Meir Simcha was the Misnaged Rav, and the Rugachev Ergon, as he was known, was the Hasidische Rav. And they used to have kind of bantering, for example, where Rav Meir Simcha would say, people say that the Rugachev Ergon has a photographic memory, but that's not true, because he just reviews Shas every hour, so consequently he doesn't have to remember anything, he just saw it. But anyway, the thing about Rav Meir Simcha I wanted to share with you is that as a Misnaged, and as a Lithuanian Misnaged, which is kind of double Misnaged, he was very, not demonstrative, not overtly emotional. Basically, he was very, very intellectual. But one time, people were up by his office, and they hear him singing and dancing, and it seemed like totally out of character. So somebody opened the door, and they see him dancing with a man and a woman and a 9-year-old child. Think about mixed dancing, a little controversial. Now, he was holding up, he was not holding the woman's hand, but either dancing in a circle together, where he was holding the father's hand and holding the little boy's hands, and the father and the child were holding the mother's hand, and they were dancing in a circle, and they were singing. Now, this seemed very, very, even more out of character. So they asked him, what's going on? And he said that they had come to him that day, and they wanted to get divorced. And he spent 6 hours talking to them and asking them to think about their child, to try to work on it once again and try to make shalom and the like. And at the end, he got everybody to be crying together and everything else. Yeah. And they decided they would try one more time to try to make things work. And he says he was so happy, he just wanted to sing and dance with them. So he was singing and dancing with them because he was able to make shalom bias. This is Rav Meir Simcha. But anyway, there are a lot of amazing things that he writes about. For example, to digress for another example, in Parshas Bechukosai, which we're going to read this coming Shabbos, which talks about the tochacha, all the awesome curses that will happen. So Rav Meir Simcha develops this view of Jewish history that when Jews have good times, and they tend to forget about God because times are very good and affluent, and we try to then solidify our achievements by escaping our sense of Jewish identity, history will often show that the non-Jews will not let us forget. If we forget who we are, we will be reminded by force. And he writes, and this is in the 1920s, and probably the Sefer was written before World War I. He writes that those Jews who look to Berlin as their new Jerusalem, referring to the Enlightenment and the like, says, will perhaps have to, unfortunately have to see that Berlin itself will be a source of great churban and great destruction. So the truth is that it's fairly clear that on some level, probably not the magnitude of it, but he had foreseen the Holocaust coming from Germany, precisely because that was a source of Jews looking to that culture, Western culture, as a substitute and a replacement for the Torah. But be it as it may, in terms of this explanation of why is it Mimachares HaShabbos, he points out the following. We have a well-known Chazal where Hashem describes Shabbos in the following way. Matana achas yesh li bebeis genazai. I have a beautiful, precious gift in my treasury. V'Shabbos Shema. And the name of that precious gift is Shabbos. Shabbos is the precious gift that I have in my treasury. Shabbos is called Matana. We say this in Shemona Esrei of the morning. Yismach Moshe. Moshe shall rejoice the matnas chelko, in the gift of his portion. Right? Shabbos is called Matana. Yom Tov is not called Matana. Why is Shabbos called a Matana and Yom Tov is not called a Matana? So he says the following. The idea of Shabbos, that God is the creator of the world, and God made the world in 6 days, and God rests, so I acknowledge God as the source of creation by resting and refraining from creativity. That is not a uniquely Jewish idea. One could have surmised that the concept of Shabbos ought to be a universal concept, because there is nothing in Shabbos that is uniquely tied to Hashem's special relationship with the Jewish people. And yet, God gave only the Jewish people the Shabbos. The non-Jewish world was not given the commandment of Shabbos. Shabbos is not one of the seven commandments of Noah. And in fact, the halacha is that if a non-Jew tries to keep all of Shabbos properly, they are deserving of death. I mean, we don't kill them. And the reason is, well, yeah, but they don't keep it. They don't keep all the malachas of Shabbos. And the reason, they'll answer the phone. And the reason is because Shabbos is a unique gift that God gave to the Jewish people, although the idea of Shabbos is not a uniquely Jewish idea. There is no logical reason why Shabbos should be ours. In fact, the halacha is that when a non-Jew converts to Judaism and they're in the practice stage, they haven't yet converted, they are not supposed to keep all of Shabbos. Obviously, they have to keep most of Shabbos just to get habituated, but they are told they should always do at least one thing wrong. They should turn on the light once in order not to be a goy who kept all of Shabbos. Now, the truth is, I'm not sure if you have to worry about this, because the laws of Shabbos are so complicated that unfortunately, all of us probably do something wrong. So even if you don't tell somebody to do something wrong, you know, they probably did something wrong because we do something wrong. In fact, they even asked the question, how could Avraham Avinu, before the Torah was given, so it says he kept the whole Torah before it was given, but since technically before Matan Torah, we have the status of Noachites, we have B'nai Noach, then how was he allowed to keep all of Shabbos? There are different answers that are given. One of the answers that are given is, well, he wore tzitzis when he walked outside. Now what does that mean? For a Jew that has a mitzvah to wear tzitzis, it's not carrying, because that's part of the Jewish male's garment. But for a Noachite who would wear tzitzis, that is Chilul Shabbos, because it's not a garment. So consequently, as a goy, he desecrated Shabbos. As a Jew, he kept Shabbos. That way, he did something which allows him to keep Shabbos as a Jew, desecrate Shabbos as a goy. This is one of the answers that is given. So that's what we mean by a matana. A matana is something that you get that has nothing to do with you directly. There's nothing. You didn't earn it. You didn't work for it. It does not commemorate any aspect of a unique relationship that God has with you. because Shabbos is a universal idea, but God gave it to the Jew. That makes it a matana. Yom Tov is different. Yom Tov could never have been given to the non-Jewish world, because all of the events of Yom Tov are inherently bound up with God's relationship to the Jewish people. Pesach, Hashem took us out of slavery. Shavuos, Hashem gives us the Torah. Sukkos, Hashem surrounds us with the clouds of glory. Now Rosh Hashanah is a little bit more problematical. Rosh Hashanah on many levels is a universal Yom HaDin. But at least if we talk about the three pilgrimage festivals, it is very, very clear that they are unique. They are given to the Jewish people not as a gift out of the blue, but they are given to the Jewish people because they commemorate the unique relationship that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has with the Jewish people. In other words, so again, Shabbos, the idea of Shabbos is universal worldwide. Yom Tov is linked specifically to the historical destiny of the Jewish people. That's why it is brought down. I saw an interesting handbook. You know, there is a movement in the world of righteous Gentiles who are not Jewish and do not even want to convert, but they want to keep the seven commandments of Noah in the proper way. So there are some books on this, and there's some websites even, and there are booklets, How Should Noah Chai. In fact, I even know somebody who's a rabbi of an Orthodox shul on Shabbos, and on Sunday he has, it sounds like Christian, but it's not Christian, he has a ministry to the Gentiles. He conducts a Noahide service for non-Jews who pray to God. They pray to God. It's not Christian at all. It's not Jewish. It's Noahide. It's the observance of the seven commandments of Noah. And there's a handbook. And there's even a recommended Shabbos service and meal. Now, it's true that Chazal say that a non-Jew is not supposed to observe Shabbos by refraining from work. But nevertheless, it's considered appropriate that Saturday be a day in which they acknowledge God as their creator. So there was a Kiddush, kind of a different, obviously, in English, and it's very, very different, not the same as ours. For example, you don't say, Asher Kiddushanu b'mitzvosav, he commanded us with his commandments. But there's a different nusach that somebody made up. And that Shabbos should be a special day with Kiddush and Haggadah and things of that nature. Now, the Meshech Chachma says, this distinction between Shabbos and Yom Tov explains two interesting halachic distinctions. And that is, we know that on Shabbos you're not allowed to cook or make food for yourself, but on Yom Tov you are allowed to cook. Why is there that difference if both of them are sacred time? So he says the following, since Shabbos represents an ideal that has nothing to do with me, right? Shabbos existed before Jews were in the world. Shabbos existed as soon as man was created. So therefore, Shabbos is an ideal that transcends my particular needs and desires. And therefore, my need for food does not override Shabbos, because Shabbos is something that is beyond me and is not connected to me. Yom Tov, on the other hand, is a celebration of the unique and special relationship that God has with the Jewish people. It is a celebration of God's love for the Jew. Since it celebrates the love that God has for the Jew, Yom Tov is subordinate to the needs that a Jewish person has. If I need to make food now because it tastes better when it's fresh than if I did it beforehand, the halacha is I do it. Yom Tov, in other words, is batel. Yom Tov is nullified. It is subservient to the needs of a Jew, because the very essence of Yom Tov is a celebration of Hashem's unique relationship to Klal Yisrael. So that explains why Yom Tov has a heter of ochel nefesh, a heter of food preparation, while Shabbos does not have a heter of food preparation. This would also explain why food preparation on Yom Tov can only be for Jews and not for non-Jews. Because once again, the heter is Yom Tov is subservient to the needs of Klal Yisrael. If it's someone else's needs, Yom Tov is not subservient, right? That's the halacha. You're not allowed to cook for a non-Jew on Yom Tov. You can only cook for a Jew on Yom Tov. In fact, the Gemara even says that one should not have a non-Jewish guest on Yom Tov. On Shabbos you could. See, it's interesting. You are allowed to have a non-Jewish guest on Shabbos because you're not going to do any cooking on Shabbos. You're not allowed to do any cooking. But on Yom Tov, the rabbis made a decree. Since you're allowed to cook on Yom Tov, you might cook extra food for the non-Jewish guest. And you're not allowed to cook for the non-Jewish guest. So they actually prohibited inviting a non-Jewish guest to a Yom Tov meal. Now this, of course, again, Shabbos is okay, Yom Tov is a problem. Now this creates a whole morass of very, very difficult problems. If you have intermarried couples and you're trying to encourage movement and the like, what do you do? And the like, you know, these are difficult problems. But be it as it may, I don't want to discuss all of those details now, but this does explain why on Shabbos there is no heter of what is called ochel nefesh, food preparation, but on Yom Tov there is a heter of ochel nefesh. This also explains a second difference between Shabbos and Yom Tov, and that is, we know that the calculation of Shabbos in no way depends on the Beis Din sanctifying time. Shabbos is automatic. 6 days followed by a Shabbos, 6 days followed by a Shabbos, 6 days followed by a Shabbos. Even if there would be no Jews in the world at all, Shabbos would be Shabbos. even if God forbid there would be no Jew in the world at all, the holiness
of
Shabbos
won't exist without Jews.
Well, that might be so, but the Shabbos would still come with Kanzmigo. Shabbos does not depend on us doing anything. Yom Tov, on the other hand, actually does, because the dates of Yom Tov are calculated from the sanctification of the new moon, Rosh Chodesh, right? Witnesses come, they see the new moon, we make that day Rosh Chodesh, and then Pesach is the 15th day, Sukkot is the 15th day, Shavuos, of course, is connected to Pesach, but you have to have sanctified the new moon of Nisan to get Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and therefore, it is said that even today, where we don't rely on sanctification by the Sanhedrin, we have calendars. The Rambam writes, the only reason we have Yom Tov today is not because astronomically we know when Nisan is and we have Pesach, but because the last Sanhedrin, under the rule of Hillel Hasheni, who was a great-grandson of the famous Hillel, calculated what the future Rosh Chodesh would be for thousands of years, and they sanctified them in advance. And the Rambam actually writes, had they not sanctified those days, there would be no Yom Tov at all. So you'd get out of cleaning for Pesach, but we would be very much impoverished. Yom Tov does not happen by itself. Yom Tov happens only because a Sanhedrin sanctified that day. And the implication of that is very startling. If they sanctify the wrong dates, Yom Tov is defined by the wrong calculation, which becomes the right calculation. This is a famous Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, where Rabban Gamliel, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, took testimony and declared a certain day to be Rosh Hashanah. Rabbi Yoshua felt that testimony was wrong, and therefore he considered Rosh Hashanah to be a day later. And Rabban Gamliel ordered him, on the day that Rabbi Yoshua thought was Yom Kippur, which would be 10 days from his Rosh Hashanah, the day after Rabban Gamliel's Yom Kippur, that he come to him wearing his money belt and carrying his cane. And Rabbi Yoshua was very perturbed because he would be desecrating what he regarded as Yom Kippur. So he went to Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva told him, you should know that whatever the Sanhedrin declared to be Rosh Hashanah, even if astronomically it was the wrong day, it becomes Rosh Hashanah. And therefore Yom Kippur is defined as the 10th day from the day that the Sanhedrin declared was Rosh Hashanah, even if they made it wrong. In fact, the Gemara seems to imply, even if they deliberately made it wrong, for whatever reason, although that was not the case there. Meaning to say, Yom Tov is a function of the holiness of Bnei Yisrael in sanctifying time. That's why we say, on Shabbos, we say the bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mikadesh HaShabbos. God sanctifies Shabbos. For Yom Tov, we say, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mikadesh Yisrael VeHazmanim. You see? You sanctify Israel, and Israel has the power to sanctify time. God does not sanctify the time without Israel. It is Bnei Yisrael who sanctify time. That's why even if it's a Shabbos and a Yom Tov, we still preserve that order. Baruch Atah Hashem, Mikadesh HaShabbos, VeYisrael VeHazmanim. We don't say Mikadesh Yisrael VeHashabbos VeHazmanim, because Shabbos does not depend on the Jews sanctifying it. You make Kiddush as a mitzvah, but Shabbos is Shabbos, whether we make Kiddush or not. But Yom Tov depends on our sanctification. Now the Meshech Chachma says, this can also be understood, because since Yom Tov is a celebration of the unique relationship that God has with the Jewish people, we are the ones who generated Yom Tov. There is only a Yom Tov because of us. Therefore, we have control over when it's established. In other words, the idea here is, therefore, that Shabbos exists independently of us. Therefore, number one, it is not subordinate to our needs, food preparation. And number two, we don't have control over its timing. Yom Tov is because of us. Right? Yom Tov is a celebration of the unique relationship Hashem has with Bnei Yisrael. Therefore, Yom Tov is subordinate to our needs, cooking, and therefore, Yom Tov, we control the timing of Yom Tov through Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctification of the Minyan.
Was Rabbi Yehoshua correct as to when Yom Tov was
called? Well, it's an argument, you know. Rabbi Yehoshua. Yeah, Rabbi Yehoshua was correct, yeah.
If Hashem Yisbarach creates us in order to be close to Him, and being close to Him is defined by doing what He has determined to be
mm-hmm.
done.
Right.
Then, if you know that this is what is supposed to be, then how does it become correct just because we determine it? But we know that that's not really what it's supposed to be. I mean, it's the same story with the river should run backwards. On
right. Well,
the
well, but that's
if
the
you know
yeah.
that it's not what Hashem wants.
Then no, but the answer is Hashem wants that the holiness of the day should be dependent on what the Beis Din does. That is the Ratzon of Hashem. Hashem basically says, "I will sanctify what you create. What you create is what I will be Mekadosh." Now, you know, there are limits. For example, if the Sanhedrin were to declare on the 15th day of the month, we'll make this Rosh Hashanah, you know, they couldn't do that. But we're talking about every month is either 30 days or 29 days. Right? So your choice of Rosh Chodesh or Rosh Hashanah is this day or that day. So within those 2 days, Hashem says whichever one they decide is the proper one. Now, generally speaking, there has to be good reason. We're not talking about arbitrary reasons. I mean, the particular issue there was witnesses testified that they saw a new moon. Rabban Gamliel accepted them. Rabbi Yehoshua said astronomically it was impossible that these witnesses could be telling the truth. But Rabban Gamliel said, well, we have witnesses. We have not proven intrinsically that they're liars, so we have to accept them. And that was the nature of the dispute over there. Rabbi Yehoshua said we shouldn't accept them because based on calculations, the moon would not have been visible at that point. No, but this is the concept. I mean, this is a very important idea. The concept is that Hashem agrees to what Klal Yisrael does, at least in this area, not in all areas.
Right. But there you have a subjective opinion versus an objective opinion of what can be and can't be. And if you're trying to make a Yom Tov or a Rosh Chodesh where it should be, then how can you fly in the face of reason and just declare that it isn't? I mean,
well, because the same, well again, this is ultimately based on Pesukim as well. The same Pesukim that tell you you have to observe a Yom Tov tell you that the definition of the Yom Tov is what the Beis Din declares. This is actually based on a pasuk. The pasuk says, Eila Moedei Hashem, these are the holidays of Hashem, Asher Tikra'u Osam Mikroi Kodesh, that you meaning Klal Yisrael, the Sanhedrin, Tikra'u will proclaim them as holy days. The drasha is, the days that you proclaim as the holy days through Rosh Chodesh are the days that Hashem says are the days that I declare as holy. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself says that I want you to be in charge of determining the Kedushas HaZman.
I think it's an important policy situation that once God determines that the holy day is interpreted through the day, and that God has two choices. Either God to be the only decider, and then there's the absolute truth, or God was going to allow human beings to interpret it, given the whole idea of Rosh Hashanah being there. Once it's turned over to human beings, there'll be a certain amount of error. I mean, it's just the nature of the human condition. And so the only way God could effectuate his will, that it's Rosh Hashanah being, is to empower the human beings who are the right human beings with the authority to interpret it, that their will govern, because even when they were wrong, even the small steps of the people were wrong. Because otherwise, if human beings were only allowed to interpret more than they were right, then there would never be any finality, because everything could always be reopened.
Right, yeah. In fact, I'll discuss this a little later on about Shavuos. But again, and I think I've given the mashal before, is that this is really a sign of Hashem's love. The example is, if I wanted to make a cake for my child, there are two ways I could do it. I could make the cake while the child is sleeping. Maybe not I, but whoever knows how to make a cake could do it. And they could do it in 20 minutes, and everything would be nice. But if they really want to show their love, they involve the child in the process of making the cake. It'll be messier, it'll be lumpier, it's not going to be as good, it will not be as perfect. But ultimately, it is a greater sign of love to involve someone in the creative process. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have decided everything. Right? Hashem could have decided, for example, what does the halacha say about surrogate motherhood? What does the halacha say about nuclear war? And even if those concepts wouldn't have made that much sense at the time of Matan Torah, he could have given Moshe a series of envelopes. One envelope says, do not open before 5760. Right? And then we would see exactly. Like, why do we have so much machlokas, uncertainty? The oral law generally is the attempt of struggling to apply the principles of God to new situations, instead of the concept of a revelation model. In fact, halacha is so discouraging of God being involved in Torah that Lo B'Shamayni, if a voice from heaven says, the halacha says, we don't listen to that. Says, nope, we got to do it ourselves. Sorry, God, you cannot tell us what to do. We take your principles and we do it ourselves. Like a child telling a parent, I'm going to do it myself. But what's the idea? The idea is that ultimately it was the Ratzon Hashem that we should be his partners in the creation of truth, even if, as you point out, it inevitably results in something that's less than true. But once again, the paradox is that becomes divine truth, meaning to say there are two levels of divine truth. There is
divine will.
I think there are two levels of divine truth, but there's one level of divine will. That is, there is an absolute objective divine will or truth, and in that situation somebody's right, somebody's wrong, because there's one answer there. But then there's another level of divine will, which is the truth as it is to be lived in this world is a function of the result one gets from following the process of halachic decision making. And even if that doesn't correspond to God's answer, God gives full credit for even the wrong answer, and that indeed becomes the right answer. Not only does it become the right answer, it may become even the only answer. When you have a Sanhedrin and they decide, and they're wrong objectively, the minority person who is right objectively now becomes wrong, and he's not even allowed to pursue his minority view. That was the story of Rabbi Eliezer, who made many, many miracles to prove that he was right, and even a voice from heaven said he was right, And Chazal say, we don't listen to you. And Eliyahu Navi was asked, what was Hashem doing at that moment? He says, Hashem was laughing. And he was saying, my children have bested me. Again, it's a very complicated idea, but it does show you that on some level, Hashem wants us to be the creators of truth. Now, this applies in all areas of halacha, but specifically today, we're not talking about all of those areas, but it certainly applies in the realm of Kiddush HaChodesh. Now, this doesn't apply to Shabbos, of course. Shabbos has its own complications. I've been assuming Shabbos is just automatic. We talked about, I think last week, issues of the land of the eternal night, right? 6 months night or 6 month day, or space travel. There are certainly issues. International dateline, which is an issue of, does halacha recognize the dateline? And almost everybody says halacha must recognize a concept of a dateline, simply because that is inherent in a circle, right? Because what's going to happen? You keep on going east, and the time gets later, and you keep on going west, and the time gets earlier. But if you go around the circle, eventually your east and your west are going to crash into each other. And are you earlier or are you later? So clearly, the Khuzari, going all the way back to the 1000s, the 11th century, emphasizes halacha recognizes a point at which the east begins and the west begins. But where is the dateline is a massive machlokas. But be it as it may, other than those problems, Shabbos does not depend on human creativity. Now, remember, this is a long explanation of, remember the question we're trying to answer. Why is the first day of Pesach referred to as Shabbos? So Mimacharas HaShabbos is the day after the first day of Pesach. So Rav Meir Simcha says like this: if we identify Shabbos as that which is given to us through no merit of our own, because Shabbos has nothing to do with the Jew, then we could say of all the Yomim Tovim, Pesach is the closest to the Shabbos Mayim. Why is that so? Because although Pesach does celebrate a unique relationship with the Jewish people, unlike Shabbos, Pesach was given to us at a time in our lives when we were not really deserving of redemption. Pesach is also a matnas chinam, a gift that was given to us even though we didn't deserve it. We know the Arizal's teaching that the Jewish people at the holiday of Pesach, at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, were on the 49th level of impurity. Very, very low. In fact, we should have been in Mitzrayim 400 years. But Hashem took us out after 210 years, because if we would have stayed another minute, we would have hit, whatever that means, level number 50, and we would have been irredeemable. The Ari learns, when it says they didn't have time to let their dough rise, how long does it take? It only takes 18 minutes at most. Because if we would have stayed 18 minutes, we would have become level number 50, whatever that means. It's true, we had some Sechusim, we had Korban Pesach, we had Bris Mila, we had not changing our names, our language, but intrinsically, ultimately, Pesach was remembering the covenant of the Avos, etc. It was not a merit that we had on our own. We were not deserving on our own. Therefore, the Meshech Chachma says, Pesach is called Shabbos, because just like Shabbos is a matana that was given to us without our earning it or deserving it, Pesach was a Yom Tov that was given to us without our earning it or deserving it. But why is that only used in connection with the Omer? In other words, the rest of the Torah, Pesach is not called Shabbos. The answer is, this highlights a connection between Pesach and Shavuos. Pesach is the redemption that Hashem gives you when you haven't deserved it and you haven't earned it. The Omer is the process of earning what Hashem has given you. To put it this way, the concept is, Pesach, Hashem, let me explain this with a statement of Rav Nachman of Breslov. Rav Nachman of Breslov, a very great Hasidic Rebbe, He still considered the Rebbe a Dresda for Hasidim. Mr. Hasidim, as you know, never got another Rebbe. This may be the way Lubavitch goes, so who knows. And they're called the dead Hasidim because the Rebbe has not been alive for 200 years. The Nachman of Breslov was a great grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, and in his own lifetime he was very controversial. The other he was not a mixer, so to speak. The other Hasidic Rebbes of Europe did not like Rav Nachman very much. But Rav Nachman had some very unusual ways. One of his ways is he teaches by stories, not only, but, and he was once asked why he teaches by stories. So his response was, if I were to tell you a shir and you didn't understand, it would be just a waste of your time. If I tell you a story, if you get the point, you learn something, and if you don't get the point, you heard a good story. So he says, what do you lose by teaching by stories? But Rav Nachman of Breslov really was one of the greatest psychologists of Hasidus, because he speaks a lot about things like loneliness, depression, sadness. These were issues that he addressed very, very much, and how to deal with being overwhelmed with life. These were inyanim that he focused on. So he actually focused on many, many issues of practical struggle that people go through. Every Shabbos is wonderful. Davening is great, right? Benching, Birchat HaMazon, wonderful thing. And then as you get used to things, and as you get more committed, and you're more meticulous in your observance, you seem to be doing better, there's sometimes a lack of desire, a lack of excitement. You're in a rut, right? Why should it be so? It's almost as if Hashem is punishing the person as they become more religious and more committed to keeping the Torah, right? Somebody who might be driving to shul, you know, maybe so excited with Kiddush and a Shabbos meal, and then when you stop driving, you know, Shabbos doesn't do it for you anymore. So he says, isn't that perverse, that the more you're keeping the commandments, the less excitement and geschmack a person has? How do we explain? In fact, there's even a joke. It's a joke that has the uncomfortable ring of truth. How do you tell when a Baal Tshuva has become fully integrated in the from community? So one of the answers is when they can bench in 1 minute. You know, because Baal Tshuva is still thinking about benching. When you're from, you know, you just skip by it very, very quickly. So Rav Nachman says the following idea. He says, when a soul is very far from Hashem, and the soul is separated from Hashem, but that soul has a yearning to become close, and of course Hashem has a greater yearning to bring us close, the person is so far from Hashem, they're in such a deep pit, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to reach down and carry them on His shoulders. And when you're carried by Hashem, there's an unbelievable lightness. Everything seems effortless. Everything seems good. Everything seems wonderful and ecstatic. But after a while, when Hashem sees that you're strong enough, He puts you down and you have to walk by yourself. And that's going to seem laborious and painful. But that's a sign of growth. The mashal He gives is exactly the mashal of a child learning how to walk. A child learning how to walk. So the child is being, right, the parents are holding the child's arms. So the child sees, gee, this walking is pretty easy. One step, two step, three step. And at some point, the parents let go. And the child plop, right, plop, plop, because he'll pick himself up, plop. And if the child can verbalize his thoughts, perhaps he or she might be thinking, how come a minute ago everything was so easy? And now it's hard. The answer is, it's the opposite. It was so easy because you were being artificially carried. But now Hashem wants you, the parents want, they're still there watching you, they're still there protecting you, they're still there to be sure you don't get hurt. But they want you to make this your own. And to make this your own, we have to remove some of the external effort, the external assistance. So Rav Nachman says, tshuva is very much that way. He says, there's a certain artificial high that Hashem gives us to get us jump-started. And we see what we're capable of being. But after we see what we're capable of being, Hashem lets go, puts us on the ground, and says, now you know what's up there. Climb the mountain yourself. Get up there yourself. That is the relationship between Pesach and Shavuos. Shavuos, I'm sorry, Pesach, now granted, we work very hard for Pesach, that's very true, but in terms of the spiritual geula that Pesach represents, that represents a vision of what we're able to become. We kind of have this view of what it's like to be on top of the mountain. But after we're on top of the mountain, Hashem takes us down and says, now that I brought you up there, I'm putting you at the bottom, and make this your own. Climb it, because you know it's there. See, if a person wouldn't have a vision of what they're capable of becoming, then they wouldn't even bother to strive to be it. And therefore, the counting of the Omer is the laborious process of transforming what God gives us into what we have achieved by dint of our own efforts and struggle. And that's why, in fact, that's the concept of the day after Shabbos, because Shabbos represents what Hashem gives you that you didn't earn. But this is the eighth day, Mimacharas. Omer is the day after that Shabbos, meaning the day beyond Shabbos, where you have to go and make it your own. That is why they say Pesach has a concept of Seder, You make a Seder. Shavuos, there's no Seder. So the concept is, Seder is when God tells you exactly what to do. Follow the dots. When there's no Seder, that connotes the confusion and ambiguity of trying to figure things out for yourself. That's why, too, the Korban of Shavuos had two loaves of wheat bread, Shtei HaLechem, and Lechem is reminiscent of what Hashem told Adam and Chava, B'zeyah Sapecha, by the sweat of your brow, Tocha Lechem. Shavuos is about internalizing the vision we have of Pesach and turn it into a concrete attribute of ourselves. In other words, Hashem always says, in fact, this is I think of Nachman's idea, it's a very important idea, because what it tells a person is that when we find things getting more difficult for us, instead of despairing or worrying about it, we could even look at it as a sign of strength, that Hashem has confidence in us that we are able to navigate through this situation. That He is no longer the parent that is holding on to our arms. He is the parent that is in back of us, letting us struggle and fall, but ready to pick us up if we get hurt. The Baal HaTanya writes, this is Merumas in the third pasuk of Shir HaShirim, where Bnei Yisrael is the woman who is crying out for their beloved, and they say, Moshcheni acharecha. We call out to God, pull me after you. What's the image? I'm kind of lying on the floor and I say, pull me after you. But then the pasuk says, Narutza, so that we can run together. In other words, Pesach is taking dead weights and schlepping it out of Mitzrayim. Shavuos is Narutza. In fact, the Meshech Chachma even brings a Midrash that we find in different Midrashim, that sometimes Bnei Yisrael are called Hashem's daughter, sometimes they are called Hashem's sister, and sometimes they are called, this is very striking, Hashem's mother. This is strange imagery. But the concept of a daughter, a baby daughter, is where a parent takes care totally of the baby's need. That's Pesach. Pesach, we are like the helpless child. Shavuos, we're like the sibling. There's a certain reciprocity. God gives us blessing, but we commit ourselves to earn those blessings by the mitzvahs and the Torah that we do. Sukkot already is a more complicated relationship, where the love that God has for us is so intense that on some level God is dependent on that love, just as a child is dependent on a parent's love. Okay, that's a separate idea. But this is the notion. The notion is that Pesach is the geula that has been undeserved and unearned, and Shavuos are taking the gifts of Hashem and making it our own. And that is why the counting of the Omer is the day after the Shabbos, because it is telling the Jew, strive for a level that goes beyond the Shabbos, that goes beyond the gift. Strive, as it were, to make Hashem's gifts your own. What does the saying go? That what you are is Hashem's gift to you, and what you do with what you are is your gift back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Pesach is Hashem's gift to us. The Omer and the Shavuos is our gift to Hashem by our Kabbalah HaTorah, our learning of Torah, our acceptance of mitzvahs. But one other question, and that is, the Sefer HaChinuch asks the question. Everyone understands that the reason why we count the Omer between Pesach and Shavuos simply is because Pesach is freedom and liberation, and Shavuos is submission to God, and Omer connects Pesach and Shavuos, and the lesson therefore is, freedom has meaning only when it's connected to faith and submission to divine will. As Eric Fromm put it, freedom cannot be freedom from restriction. That's just absence of restriction. Freedom has to be towards something noble. Right? One of the big issues in the United States, in affluent Western cultures, is that we have articulated a concept of freedom that is based on not having anybody tell you what to do. And that type of freedom does not create happiness in life. That type of freedom creates aimlessness, confusion, despair, depression, anger, culminating in an extreme situation in either teenage suicide or actual murder, or often both, murder followed by suicide. Because when a human being does not have a meaning or a purpose in life, life can become very unbearable. We don't realize, we sometimes think, oh, if only I wouldn't have all of these restrictions, life would be great. In point of fact, life would be very unbearable without a sense of values that give a person foundation and rootedness and everything else. So the simple meaning, of course, is that we connect freedom with submission to Hashem, right? That's the idea. But the Sefer HaChinuch asked the Kasha, if that's so, why don't I start Svira the first day of Pesach? Why don't I come the first day? Why the second day of Pesach? Which in Eretz Yisrael is not even a Yom Tov. Start the first day of Pesach. So the Sefer HaChinuch says a simple answer, although it doesn't, not entirely clear. His answer is that we have a klal in Halacha called Ein Ma'arvin Simcha V'Simcha. You don't want to mix two causes of joy together. An example would be, you don't make a wedding during Chol HaMoed, even though you're allowed to drive, you're allowed, everything that you do in a wedding, you're allowed to do, but you don't get married in Chol HaMoed. And the reason is because Chol HaMoed is also part of Yom Tov where you rejoice, and you don't want to detract from the Yom Tov rejoicing by making a wedding, and you don't want to detract from the wedding. We would think the opposite. We think, well, gee, if it's a double simcha, even better. That was not the mindset of Chazal. Chazal saw that when you're involved in one simcha, your mind should be totally focused on that simcha. And if you're thinking about the joy of the wedding, you know, your heart is not totally about Yom Tov. So Ein Ma'arvin Simcha the Simcha. So the Sefer HaChinuch says that's the same idea, that the first night of Pesach, where we're concentrating so much on Yetzias Mitzrayim, we don't start our countdown to the next holiday. It almost sounds like we want to get out of Pesach, we're looking forward to the next step. So we don't think about Shavuos till the next day. That's what the Sefer HaChinuch says, which already, at least in Eretz Yisrael, is no longer a holiday, or it's no longer a Yom Tov. It is a getter of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. Although I may have told you this, I think there is an interesting remez. You know, the first day of Pesach is always the same night of the week as Tisha B'Av. That's why we eat an egg, because an egg is a food that you give to a mourner. So it occurs that perhaps there's a certain inner meaning here, because the first night of Pesach is the only night that's not yet connected to Shavuos by counting the Omer. So the first night of Pesach is freedom without Torah. So maybe the lesson is, freedom without Torah turns into Tisha B'Av. In other words, it eventually leads to destruction. That's the idea. It is that day without Torah that B'Davka is the day of
Tisha B'Av. So the 49 days are without Torah until we get the Torah.
No, we're preparing ourselves. But in our mind, we're working on accepting Hashem's Torah. So that's one answer to the Sefer HaChinuch gives. Now the Torah Tumimah gives a different answer. He says we find that Matan Torah is compared to a wedding between Hashem and the Jewish people. Right? It's a chasen. In fact, many Sephardic congregations, instead of reading before the Aseres HaDibros, Akdamos, which is an Aramaic poem about Matan Torah, they actually have a text of a kesuvah, a marriage contract. Hashem is the chasen, and it's written in the form of a kesuvah. Hashem is the chasan, Bnei Yisrael are the kala, Hashem says, Hareyat Mekudeshesli, you are betrothed to me, etc. It's a marriage. Now we know that before a woman is allowed to have marriage, before people can get married, the woman has to have 7 clean days as part of Nida, 7 clean days. And therefore it is said that the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos correspond to the 7 days that a nida must be separated from her husband to reach a stage of purity and renewal. However, the first day of Pesach cannot count as one of the clean days, because we started off that day in Mitzrayim. We were still in the Tumah of Mitzrayim. So just as there has to be a Hefsek Tara, the day in which the bleeding stops, and the seven clean days begins the day after, so the Torah Tumimah says the first day of Pesach corresponds to the Hefsek Tara, and then we have the seven clean days, a week, you know, a week per day afterwards. So that's a whole imagery of, in fact, Torah Tumimah wants to say that maybe there's a remez, this is why we don't do marriages during Sfira, because the whole period of Sfira, of course, that's, I mean, the reason that's given is because of the students of Rabbi Akiva dying, but maybe there's a remez that this is a Nida period. Of course, I mean, that obviously cannot be taken literally. If that would be true, then, you know, people who are already married would also be forbidden, and that we don't say. But this is yet another reason why it's Mimachalas HaShabbos, because the first day of Pesach is the day in which we separated from the Tumas Mitzrayim, therefore it becomes a day of Hefsek Tara. Now I just want to go back a little bit. You know, Friday we had Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer. And since I didn't, I was going to talk about Lag BaOmer last week, I didn't get to it last week. I just want to say a few words about the 33rd day of the Omer. The 7 weeks of Sfira, Kabbalistically, are very, very significant, because the 7 weeks of the Omer, each week corresponds to one of the seven Sefiros. Now what are Sefiros? Sefiros are emanations of divine characteristics that suffuse the world. And we say, there are actually 10 Sefiros, but the first three are called intellectual Sefiros, and the last seven are called emotional Sefiros. So the first three refer to God's wisdom and God's understanding, and they're kind of the brain, as it were. But the last seven refer to various, what we would call, emotional manifestations of divinity that we experience in the world. Let me first enumerate them. The seven are chesed, loving kindness, which is the emotion and behavior of giving. The second is gevura, which is inner strength, and that refers to judgment, which is withholding, not necessarily in a negative way, but withholding of divine energy. The third is said to be tiferes, which is beauty or truth. Right? John Cade said beauty is truth, truth is beauty. Well, indeed, I don't know if he was a Kabbalist, but indeed it is true that Tiferes is beauty, and it's also defined as the Midah of Emes. And the way this is understood, let me take it, because the basic out of the seven, the latter four basically emanate from the first three. So the first three are the basic thing that you have to get. The world exists every second with a constant balance and struggle between the impulse to give and the impulse to hold back. Because if God were to allow all of His light to flood the world, we would not exist, we would be overwhelmed, we would be destroyed. So God has to hold back a little bit, otherwise the kelim, the utensils, would smash. So chesed is the giving, gevur is the holding back. If there's too much chesed, we cease to exist as autonomous choosing creatures. Chesed needs to be balanced with gevur. When there's too much gevur, there's judgment and evil in the world. So chesed, gevura are always fighting. When they achieve a synthesis and a balance and a harmony, that is called the Midah of Tiferes. So Tiferes, which is beauty, is the reconciliation of opposites to achieve a harmony. Now we understand how this applies in human life, because in human life as well, as parents or whatever, teachers, we have the constant struggle, giving, withholding. How do you achieve that balance? We are told that each of the Avos exemplifies these midos. Avraham exemplifies the midah of chesed. But as the Zohar says, an overabundance of chesed can produce a Yishmael in the world. You let your child have whatever he wants. Yitzchak represents the midah of introspection. Yitzchak was withdrawn into his own development of Avodas Hashem. But too much gevura can produce an Esav. It is said to be Yaakov that harmonizes the Chesed of Avraham and the Gevurah of Yitzchak, that produces an entire Jewish people, Mitaso Shleim, all of his children are Klal Yisrael, and Yaakov represents, in fact we also know Yaakov represents Torah, because Torah, above all, is a guide in synthesizing. When do you give? When do you take? When do you share? When do you hold back? The Torah itself gives a person a guide. In fact, the Maral says, that is why Torah is connected to the notion of three. Because if you imagine a triangle, you have two opposite points that meet at an apex. So three is the number of synthesizing forces that are opposites and bringing them together in the right way. That is the trilogy, that is the synthesis, the apex of a triangle that synthesizes the opposite points. Now, so the basic of the seven spheres, the basic idea is Chesed and Gevura need to be reconciled into an optimum mix of Tiferes. Now, the latter four are really replays or ramifications of the first three. The fourth Sphira is Netzach. Now, Netzach has different translations. Netzach could mean eternity. Netzach can mean endurance, which is connected to eternity, the ability to stay with it. And Netzach can mean victory. They're all related. Victory, endurance, eternity. That is connected to the Midah of Moshe Rabbeinu. How is that so? Netzach is a form of chesed that is expressed in terms of gevura. What do we mean? What does Moshe give us? Moshe gives us rules, regulations, restrictions, guidance. He ties our hand. We are restricted. But the restrictions ultimately emanate in terms of loving kindness, to give us a way to know how to live our lives. So it's giving us something. It is giving us by restraining us. So it is a chesed that manifests itself through gevura. So it's a combination of chesed and gevura. Chesed in terms of giving us instruction. Gevura in terms of the instruction I'm giving you is to tie your hands. The next sphira is hod. Hod is translated as glory, and that's identified as the Midah of Aaron. Now, hod is the opposite. Hod is when you restrain yourself, you step back to let the other person's individuality shine through. In other words, it's a stance of gevura. I withhold the revelation of my individuality to give you the chesed of becoming your own person. So Netzach, the image of Netzach would be, put it in human terms, Netzach is the midah of the overprotective parents who, in the desire to shield and protect the child, showers the child with restriction and rule and limitation out of their love for the child. Hod is the midah of stepping back. So it's gevura in the sense of stepping back, but for the chesed, it's also a combination of chesed, for the chesed of allowing that person's individuality to reveal itself. That's the midah of Aaron, who is a lover of peace, in which he let each person become the person they were capable of becoming. Now, the downside of hod is you can have a cheta ego. Aaron lets people do their thing, and it results in the cheta ego. But the positive aspect of hod is the stepping back to see the other's uniqueness and individuality. So Netzach is a chesed that expresses itself in gevura and limitation. Hod is a gevura, a withholding, that is an expression of giving to the other person. What are you giving to them? You're giving to them the gift of discovering themselves. You're not giving them anything, but by withdrawing, you're enabling them to become unique. Right? So in a sense, therefore, Netzach and Hod, Moshe and Aaron, is a reprise on a different level of the tension between Chesed and Gevura. Chesed is the giving, Gevurah is the withholding. Netzach is the giving to a person by way of restriction and limitation. Hod is withdrawing to enable the person's autonomy and freedom to shine forth. Well, just as Chesed and Gevurah need a reconciliation through Tiferes, Netzach and Hod also need a synthesis, right? As a parent, how do I synthesize? And that is the Midah of Yesod, the foundation, which is connected to Yosef. Yosef is said to be, in his own life, this balance between Netzach and Hod. And the reason this is so is because on one hand, Yosef got all of the instruction from Yaakov Avinu before he was sold, all the Torah, but he had to play it out in his own life, away from family, away from positive influences. He became autonomous, independent, free of that structure, so he had the Netzach and the Hod in his own life. By the way, you'll notice how this is not in chronological order. The order of the Sviros is Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, and I'll mention the seventh of them is David, I'll mention that in a moment. And this is important because the Ushpizin and Sukkis are based on the seven Sviros. And since the minhag of the Ushpizin comes from the Ari, so the correct order of the Ushpizin is indeed Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, and David. Now, I did see that some other nuschos have tried to rationalize it by drawing chronologically, with Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, Moshe, Aaron, but that appears not to be correct, because the whole concept of Ushpizin is a mystical idea. It is not, and therefore, to import a rational chronological sequence on a mystical idea would be mixing two different things. Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron. Yeah, Moshe, Aaron. Right, Moshe is five. Moshe is four. Aharon is five. Yosef is six. And the seventh one is David. Now, the seventh Svira is called Malchus, kingship. What is kingship? So the Zohar says, kingship is empty. Kingship is nothing at all. In other words, it's hard to picture this, but imagine the idea, it's kind of a very mechanical, machine-like contraption. Imagine a contraption with all, in other words, the divine presence flows into different channels, a channel of Chesed, a channel of Gevurah, a channel of Tiferes, a channel of Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and it all gets mixed in, and our tefillos and our mitzvahs determine how much goes into each channel. But when it all gets mixed together, it has to go through a single conduit to become expressed and visible in this world. And Malchus is the final spigot, or the final pipe, to which all of these different colors go through. Malchus is empty. Malchus is the conduit by which all the other spheros reveal themselves into the world. And that's why it's called Malchus. Hashem's kingship is what is revealed in the world. Now, that's why David HaMelech is considered to be the repository of God's kingship. Because David HaMelech realized that he was nothing in the world but a conduit for God. David HaMelech didn't even have his own life. David HaMelech borrowed 70 years from Adam HaRishon. Adam should have lived 1,000 years, and he only lived 930 because he gave 70 to David. Malchus, the Zohar says, lesle mi garmei klum, which means in Aramaic, it has nothing of its own. It is just a conduit. Now, again, obviously this is not a full explanation of any of this, but just to be familiar with it in a very, very rough way.
He accomplished a lot in the sentence.
Now, the thing I want to share with you is, and many of you probably know this, each week of Svira, of the Omer, corresponds to one of these divine spheros. Week one is the week of Chesed in the world. Week two is the Midah of Gevurah in the world. Right? Week three is the Midah of Tiferes in the world. Now, not only that, But because there are 7 days in every week, each day within a week is associated with that theme. Now this creates a little confusion. So for example, the way we refer to the first day of Svira, we refer to it as the day of Chesed Shebechesed, the day of loving kindness in the week of loving kindness. Day 2 of Svira, we call it Gevura Shebechesed, the day of inner strength within the week of loving kindness. Now, if you were to ask me, what is the difference between day 2 and week 1 and day 1 of week 2? Right? Day 2 of week 1 is called Gevura of Chesed. Day 1 of week 2 is called Chesed of Gevura. Right? These are subtle distinctions. I did see a Chabad rabbi put out a kind of a chart that's called a 49 steps or something about Svira, in which he uses this classification to suggest every single day of Svira a certain midah that you concentrate on. So it's useful. Although I would have to say, you know, sometimes these things, you know, we're such a spoiled culture, we only like the love and chesed stuff, so he kind of manages, you know, even Gevurah and Gevurah, he manages to turn into some love, giving love type of thing, but I think sometimes it's a little artificial because we shy away from the parts that are more rigorous and demanding. You know, so that's a kind of a problem with the simplification of these things. But here's the point, though. Now think about this. Now this is an amazing thing. Once you understand this system, or at least see it generally, let's take Lag Ba'Omer. What week is Lag Ba'Omer in? Lag Ba'Omer is in the fifth week, right? Because 28 days at the end of 4 weeks. So 29, 30, 31, 32, 33. Lag Ba'Omer is the fifth day of the fifth week. Now, the fifth week is the day of Hod, glory, which is Aaron. The fifth day of the fifth week is Hod Shebahod, the glory of glory. It's a double dose of Aaron. Why is that significant? Remember what the Midah of Hod is. Hod is the Midah where you see the individuality and uniqueness of the other. And you don't try to give to him by imposing things on him, even if you think that's good, but you give to him by withdrawing and letting that person shine, letting that radiance emerge, seeing the specialness of that person. Well, we know that Lag Ba'Omer is a festive day because that was the day that the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. The students of Rabbi Akiva died because they did not show proper respect for each other. Kavod, they did not show honor for each other. What is honor? Rav Shimshon HaFalhirsch says, kavod is related to the word for heaviness. What does that mean? Kavod does not mean you open the door for somebody, or you're polite, or you say please and thank you. But it means you look at the other person as being weighty, significant. In fact, we even use the word gravitas, kind of a Latin English word. Somebody has weight. In other words, you could be polite to somebody and consider them totally, you know, having nothing to say. A lightweight, they even use the expression. Well, kaved is you regard them as a heavyweight, meaning you see that they have something to offer. So isn't it a wonderful thought that precisely on Lag Ba'Omer, when the spiritual koach that's in the world is the midah of Aaron HaKohen, who had the midah of Hod, where you step back and he would see the greatness of the other, that's precisely the day that the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva were able to transcend the pettiness and the rivalry of Loi Nagu Kavod. And that is why the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying.
Why didn't he stop them from when he saw what they got?
Well, again, because this is a much more subtle thing. So this is what we're saying. The students of Rabbi Akiva were undoubtedly polite to each other. They were not slamming doors in people's face. They were not rude. The chisara was a much more internal chisara, where each one thought there was not a lot I could learn from the other one.
And Rabbi Akiva didn't see that to stop them?
Well, Rabbi Akiva, I don't know. Rabbi Akiva may have tried to stop them, but you know, once again, these are things that are deep in a person's soul. By the way, Chaim Shmulevitz even says, the mitzvah of honoring your parents, kabed es avicha, He says an interesting point. He says, if kavod refers to the attitude of seeing something significant, not just behavior, he says that part of the mitzvah is a person is obligated to look at their parents and to identify a quality that is admirable and worthy of emulation. Meaning, if a person simply says, oh, my parents are not particularly good, but, you know, I'm a good child, so I will keep a mitzvah, he says that's not entirely the mitzvah. The mitzvah also requires that you try to identify. Now, it may be, well, Baruch Hashem, I think for most of us it shouldn't be that hard, Baruch Hashem, but the point is that a person is obligated to try to see in their parents some great good midah that is worthy of them to emulate. And one does not fulfill kibud of the aim until they have seen that midah. I've mentioned this before, but I'll just give you an example of how this can come up even in unlikely scenarios. And I'm probably repeating myself, but it is a good, as Rav Nachman said, it is a good story. This involved a person who grew up in Falls Church, Virginia. He was not a religious person. He was totally assimilated, not even reformed. And he went to Eretz Yisrael for college. He became not only a Baal Tshuva, but he became a Gerer Chassid. Very, very unusual. Not too many people with knickers and knee socks and shtreimel and payas. And I knew the person when he was just regular Orthodox, but I happened to have been in Eretz Yisrael when he became a Gerer Chassid, and he was getting married to a woman who was a British woman who had also become a Gerer Chassida, whatever it is. I don't even know how that would happen. And they were getting married in Nea Sharim, and I happened to have been in Israel at the time, so I was at the wedding. And in Nea Sharim, you know, it's not, the issue is not Mechitza, the issue is the women were in a different building. The women were in one building and the men were in another building. And the parents, I felt a little out of place. I, you know, I wore a black hat. I looked like a yeshiva student, but I was out of place. You know? So, you know, it wasn't my thing. You can imagine how the parents felt. Parents are, this was like a Twilight Zone. This was like a different, this was a different universe. This was not the world as they knew it at all. And I still remember that the father, who is not alive anymore, Aleph HaShalom, was wearing a big button that said, please don't smoke around me. And of course, he's sitting next to, you know, Mei Sharon, you know, they smoke very, very heavily there. And the language was Yiddish. I mean, people weren't even speaking Hebrew, just Yiddish and other things. So, at the end of the chasna, for Sheva Brachos, they do bring the Kala back into the chasna's room so they could sit together for Sheva Brachos. So when his parents were together, the boy got up with a shtreimel and payas and everything else, and he spoke and he said he wanted to thank his parents for raising him. And he said even though he lives a totally different life than they would have imagined, he says he wants them to know that 90% of what he is from them, and the 10% that isn't is because they gave him the strength to find his own way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how the parents took that. I don't know. But to me it was a tremendously a tremendous statement, because here you have someone who adopted a way of life that really rejected everything that his parents stood for, and yet he recognized that in the process of becoming a religious Jew, you don't destroy who you are, but you basically say that that too was something I got from my past. Even the ability to rebel, the ability to change, the ability to make a decision, something my parents gave me. So this is the example of looking at one's background and looking at it and seeing it in a positive way. But and in many ways, there are other things. I mean, you can look at people who are Mechallel Shabbos, but you could look at them as their honesty, their strength, their courage, the fact that when life was difficult, they managed to be resilient. I mean, there, you know, you can make lists of hundreds and hundreds of qualities that can, you know, be something that you can look at one's parents or one's family and say that these are qualities that are good qualities. Chazal were not ashamed or embarrassed to look at Esav and look at him as, with all of Esav's faults, right, to look at him as somebody who truly fulfilled kibud av v'yayin. And it wasn't just a biblical figure. They looked at Goyim in the time, like Dama ben Nesina, was a non-Jew from Ashkelon, and Chazal pointed him up as the exemplar for the people of their generation. Okay, so as Chaim Shmulevitz says, this is part of the mitzvah of kibud of the end. One should try to identify those types of qualities. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. I wish you all a good Shabbos.